I want to welcome you back. It's been a while since we've had church in the daytime. Church while it's light out. So I lost my voice. I asked my dad if I could borrow his for tonight. So he gave me his voice to use tonight. I feel like I sound exactly like my dad to myself right now. It's bizarre. It's like an out-of-body experience. I kind of do anyway, but especially now, I don't know what happened. Hopefully I can preach like my dad tonight. Okay, well, we're going to dive back into Genesis, and I think what we're going to do tonight is finish. One is never done with Genesis. But we want to move through the rest of the first major section of the book, which is in chapters 1 through 11. I just want to remind you of the way that the book is structured. Okay, chapters 1 through 11 gives us the story of the creation of mankind, their rebellion, and their subsequent downfall, and all the fallout from the entry of sin into the world. In chapter 12, the story shifts from being one about mankind in general to being one of a particular man named Abraham, who was chosen by God to make a family and eventually become a nation, who would become a source of blessing upon the families and the nations of the earth. So these two sections are often called the primeval history, chapters 1 through 11, and the patriarchal history, beginning with Abraham, moving through Isaac, Jacob, and finally with Joseph. Primeval history and the patriarchal history. But the connection between those two main sections, what links them together, is really what Genesis is all about. Okay? When we look at those two stories and the story that they're trying to tell, this is where Genesis really hammers home what it's about to us. God began a very good thing. God created the world. But because of mankind's rejection of God and through their disobedience, sin entered the world along with a curse. And so the very good thing that God began became cursed, and death and decay and destruction started to have its way in the earth. And there were a few men, as we've seen so far, who showed signs of relating to God in the way that he desired, in the way that we were created. One of the good phrases to describe that would be walking with God. Walking with God. And so far we saw Abel pleased God with his offering. Enoch walked with God. Various of Seth's lineage. We hear that people at that point began to call upon the name of the Lord when Seth's line was started. But on the whole, humanity is in a downward spiral. And so when Abraham enters the story, the ancient readers of Genesis would have seen, this is where it all began, right? It began with Abraham. But why Abraham? What is the problem that God chose Abraham to begin to address? What is the question that God's choice of Abraham begins to answer? And chapters 1 through 11 set the stage for then God's people, the nation of Israel, to understand what they are here for, okay? And so Genesis is so rich and so multi-layered. And we need to understand that there are a lot of microcosms in the book of Genesis, if that makes sense. So a microcosm, micro is just small, cosms, world, cosmos. But when something is a microcosm, it means that it's that large thing just shrunk down into all the components are there, but it's just smaller. It's a smaller part. And so when God chooses Abraham, he takes a part of humanity. And in the story of Abraham, then, he works out, once again, the story of Adam, which is the story of all mankind, but it's in a microcosm, okay? Eden the Garden of Eden, the place where Adam or God placed Adam, is a microcosm itself. It's a microcosm of the heavenly temple. Okay, Eden is a temple. We'll see tonight that the ark becomes a microcosm of all of the created world. God packs into the ark kind of the essential core sample of life. And he uses that to then start over. So these microcosms are all over the place. But Israel itself is a microcosm of humanity. And that's so important to the understanding of the gospel. That's so important to your reading of a book like Romans. Right, where Paul is saying that it doesn't start with Abraham, it starts with Adam, whose name literally means mankind. God created mankind, all of humanity. He doesn't dislike most of humanity and just like part of humanity. God loves the world. God sends his son to save the world. How does he save the world? Through his people. And so the story of Israel at chapter 12. The story of Israel is a retelling of the story of mankind in general, but on a small and individual scale. Okay, and you'll see, I mean, through the story of Israel, you'll see the same things play out. And this is actually what's really underneath the gospel. This is why Paul says Christ had to come into the world. It's what the gospels, it's the story the gospels are telling. It's why Matthew begins his story with a genealogy. Because something needs to be done to save mankind. Not only that, something needs to be done to save God's plan of salvation for mankind, which was his people. And so the gospel accomplishes both. Jesus is the Messiah, the son of David. But he's also, as Luke tells us, a son of Adam. And he's a new and greater Adam. Okay, so we go back to Abraham, but we also go back to Adam. Hopefully you're tracking with me in some sense. So Genesis gives us those two, you could call them altitudes, to look at the story of God. The 30,000 foot, which is 1 through 11, and maybe the 10,000 foot, which begins in chapter 12, and it zooms way in, but it's telling the same story. It's a microcosm, okay? These chapters, within chapter 1 through 11, let me explain this as well. Within chapters 1 through 11, we have the same story told twice. First in chapters 1 through 6, at the beginning of chapter 6. And then when the flood starts, the flood narrative starts, we're telling the story again. Okay? And there's an arc from chapter 1 to 6. Okay? And it's waters. Right? We begin in verse 1, Spirit of God hovering over the waters. There's nothing there. It's chaos. And then God begins to form and separate, put the waters, make dry land. And all these creative acts of God through his word are very good. Okay, what the flood is an act of decreation. And by the time it's done, it's all water again. Okay, so God says, nothing of the very good is still here. And so we need to wipe everything, blot everything out. Which is like wash it away, literally, and so that's what the flood is. So try and track with me here, okay? In the creation narrative, chapters 1 and 2, the creation of the cosmos from the waters of chaos, okay? Humans created in the image of God. God blesses them and he says, be fruitful and multiply. Then we zoom in, right, in chapter 2. We zoom into God creating man from the clay of the earth. And God creates Eden. But he also creates a garden within Eden. And this is going to be important to the flood story, because there's all the land, the earth, and then there's part of the earth that's Eden, and then there's part of Eden that's the garden. And then in the middle of the garden, there's the trees. Okay, now just Think about that. You have these various levels of what I would say nearness to the heavenly realm, nearness to God. God comes down to walk with man in the cool of the day. And so there's two trees. One is the tree of life, partaking of life. And one is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which means we go our own way. You decide. You take on the burden of right and wrong. You sort through life. You decide. God says, don't choose that. That's death. When you sever the relationship with me, it's death. So they sin. There's creation and blessing. Then they sin and there's a failure. Okay? There's a rebellion. Then we have a story of the next generation in chapter 4. So we have sin. There's nakedness. Remember, that's part of the fall. There's the curse that comes in. And then ultimately exile. Okay? So by the next generation, we have sin. We have the division between the brothers. We have the murder. The firstborn is not accepted. This is going to be a recurring pattern, especially in the patriarchal history. The firstborn is not accepted. And then you have more curse and more exile, wandering, going out. We're not traveling up into the presence of God. We're going out away from the presence of God. Then you have these two lines that we've set up in chapter 4, the lineage of Cain leading to Lamech. This is not God's kind of chosen seed. And then you have from Adam to Noah through Seth. You have 10 generations culminating in 3 sons. And this is kind of God's chosen lineage. This is when people begin to call upon the name of the Lord. Finally, you get to the beginning of chapter 6, which is where we left off last week. And you have this couple strange verses where the sons of God come into the daughters of men. And we talked about two possibilities, and no one can really say for sure. I'm probably more in the camp that that it was some sort of heavenly being that transgressed that divide between heavenly and earthly and caused a disruption, that they were transgressing. And so really this is kind of a transgression of heavenly beings infiltrating or invading a realm that's not theirs. Okay? And similar language is used for these sons of God. It's like they looked and they saw. It's the similar language between Eve and when she looked and she saw the fruit, saw that it was good. These sons of men looked and they saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. And they came down and they married them. All right. And so God says, man, we have this heavenly rebellion. And then, so these heavenly beings are transgressing. And then when I look upon the earth, it says in chapter 6, the Lord saw... 6 verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. In verse 11, it says, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and this is Genesis 1 language, God saw the light, that it was good. Anytime God creates something, he sees it. God saw that what he created, and it was good. God saw and it was good. God saw and it was good. God saw the earth and behold, it was corrupt. It's not good. The goodness is gone. For all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Okay? So that's where we end up at the end of the first story. And then God decrees destruction. So then what happens is the story resets, okay? So then in chapter 6, and let's walk through this, there is an act of decreation, okay? All the stuff that God had created gets covered back up with water. Even the firmament that divided the waters above and the waters below, even that, God says there's no more boundaries. All of his order is gone, and he withdraws all of his good order, and it all becomes once again this chaotic deep that covers everything. But in the middle of that, there's this ark, okay? And it contains, all right, let's look at the ark. It contains, by the way, when God instructs Noah, in this whole story of the flood, more time is spent on the ark itself and the contents of the ark than are ever spent on the flood. Right? The flood basically happens and it's like, yep, the waters covered the earth. It rained 40 days and 40 nights. Yep, it happened. But so much detail, and this is like a lot of detail for where we are in this story. So much detail is given to the construction of the ark, the filling of the ark, these commands. It's very, very similar. Very, very similar to when God gives instructions to Moses on Mount Sinai for the way he's to build the temple, the tabernacle at that point. And all of the regulations and how they are to live their lives. And it says Noah found favor. Noah found favor with the Lord. You say, what did he do? How was he different? I don't know exactly. I know that something about Noah caught God's eye. God had grace. A lot of it was probably God's, just his grace. Right? It wasn't necessarily deserved by Noah. But God looks at Noah, and one thing that we can see is it says that Noah is blameless. Oh, where is this? Noah found favor with the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. Noah walked with God. That is a fellowship. That is a nearness. That is a very accurate picture of what God desired from the beginning in his relationship with mankind. It's what he came down to do in the cool of the day. The Lord came down to walk in the garden in the cool of the day. All right, so he says, so he walked with God. But one thing that you hear repeated through this story is that when God tells him to do something, it says, and all that the Lord commanded, Noah did it. He did it. He responds to the word of God. And Hebrews tells us that this was a part of his faith. By faith, he built this ark. And by doing so, he condemned an entire generation. Okay. So God tells him how to make the ark. chapter 6 through 9 are really the second cycle of a creation story. Okay. God undoes creation, then he recreates. Noah is the new Adam. And he even tells him, be fruitful and multiply. He says, I give you these things for food, etc., etc. There's so many parallels between Noah and Adam. He blesses him. He establishes a covenant with him. But Noah finds himself, we're going to finish this overview, and then I'm going to get down on a couple details in this story. Noah finds himself in a garden, in a vineyard. But lo and behold, he gets drunk and he's naked. This sounds familiar, right? The man in the garden attempting his task, but all ultimately failing. Then you have next generation. Okay, what happens? It's brothers, and there's a division amongst brothers. Ham comes in and he sees his father's nakedness and goes and he tells his other brothers. There's an implication of a disrespect, right? At least in Noah's eyes. And Shem and Japheth come in and they walk backwards and they cover up their father. Okay, so two different ways two different ways. And so the brothers are divided. And when Noah comes to and he understands what happens, he curses Ham. And so you have one in the next generation, you have one who's cursed and one whose lineage goes on, a chosen lineage. So that they spread out along the face of the earth. They're fruitful and they multiply, just like Genesis 4, right? These, and then the beginning of 5. The generations continue. The earth is filled after the new creation, the recreation through Noah and his sons. But then you have the Babel, the Tower of Babel. Now, if in chapter 6, it was a rebellion in heaven that caused these sons of God to transgress and come down, in chapter 11, it's a rebellion of the sons of Adam charging up into heaven, right? Do you see it's kind of a reversal? Let's build a tower. We can, of our own volition, get into heaven. Just like the sons of God said, hey, we're going to go down. We like what's going on the earth. We're going to go down and be a part of that. Just because it seems good to us, right? It seemed good to the people building the tower. Let's build a name for ourselves. And let's build this tower. Let's build a city and a tower all the way up into heaven. What's stopping us? Right? We got bricks. We figured bricks out. We're going to the skies. All right? So, then that brings not a global flood because God said, we're not going to do that again. Then what happens at the end, that second cycle, God says, I'm going to choose a man. Right? Where he chose Noah at the end of that cycle, he says, I'm going to choose a man. And God no longer deals in these global judgments. Right? Because at the end of the Noah story, he says, I'm done with that. We're going to work this out in a new way. All right. Does that make sense, that kind of outline? It's, if you go and kind of read through it again, look at the halfway point where the flood begins, look at everything that's happened up to that point, and then trace it out. Right? The creation story, the flood is just an inversion of the creation story. It's a reversal. Everything is reversed. And you can even kind of map out, it says which day is which. And it's a pretty cool thing to look at. It's a pretty cool parallel. But basically God is saying, we're going back to the beginning. We're going back to Spirit of God hovering over the waters. Which, by the way, what was flying over the waters at the end of the story? It's a dove. Right? A dove is flying around over the waters. Right? Until the dry land appears. All right, so a couple other things I want to point out. The ark, right? What is the ark? They built a life-size ark down the road. You know, people go and see the ark. The ark is like a fascinating thing. It's like maybe the first story you learn from the Bible. It's Noah and the ark. And I was on the way in, I heard it's going, who built the ark? Noah. Was that what she was saying? Yeah, I heard it on the way in. We got the ark. The ark is a fascinating thing. It's not a big boat. Okay? It's not a boat. It's not a watercraft. It was not designed to be a seaworthy vessel. Okay? That's not what an ark is. An ark is basically just an Egyptian word for a box or even sometimes a coffin. Okay? An ark is not... It's just a box. Okay? It's why the ark, the same word was used for whatever they put Moses in. Okay? So there's no steering, there's no sails, there's no oars, there's nothing. It just floats. And so the ark can't do anything. The ark has no say in what happens other than it's just floating on top. Okay? So the ark is not meant to be a ship. Right, and Moses isn't like an admiral of the new humanity. That's not what's going on. What's happening is God is saying, I need to judge. All of creation has become corrupt through the evil of humanity. But I'm going to save, I'm going to preserve a part of it. And on the other side of this judgment, I am going to relaunch creation. Okay, so you see two things here. The judgment of God, right? That God was very patient. And it even says if that 120 years thing that he says, if that was to be a warning, that's a long warning. Right? First Peter points out God's patience in the days of Noah. God was being patient. And he kept looking. He kept looking. The Psalms say that God looks down to see if there are any who understand. They're all gone astray. Okay, and so God was looking, looking. He found Noah, but that was about it. Now that kind of thing's going to happen again, right? With Lot. And Abraham says, hey, will you spare this place? If there are 50 righteous, 30, 20, 10? And he says, yes, I will. But there wasn't. And so at this point, God says, it is better for all of this to go back, to be blotted out, than for it to continue in the way it is. And God wasn't, it doesn't say that God was just fuming mad. It says that God was cut to the heart. That God was grieved in his heart. And when God looked down, he goes, you know what? They have to. It's just, you never see God lash out in anger here, which is so surprising to me. You see humans lash out in anger, but you never see God lash out in anger. He administers justice and judgment, but he never lashes out in anger. He's supremely patient. So he says, I have determined to make an all flesh, an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And then he gives instructions for the ark. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Gopher is just a transliteration of the Hebrew. It's not like a, it's just, the Hebrew word is literally gopher. Okay? So we don't know, is this a species of tree, a type of wood? Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you are to make it. The length of 300 cubits. A cubit is about like halfway in between a foot and a meter, right? It's like this length, elbow to fingertip, about 18 inches or so. 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above and set the door of the ark in its side. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. Now, if you study this, this is a temple. This is 100% a temple. All right, if you look, all the temples have this three-part structure. Okay, there's three stories in the ark. All the temples have, well, for example, the Ark of the Covenant. Right? It's actually, that word is used, the Ark of the Covenant. Its dimensions are spelled out, right? And then it says, and overlay gold inside and out. Right? It's a very similar thing. And inside the ark, in Noah's ark, we have man and his family, and we have seven pairs of all the clean animals, two pairs of all of the unclean animals. So enough to start over, enough to begin again on the other side of this judgment. Why is it seven pairs, you know, of the clean animals? First thing Noah did after he was able to come out of the ark was what? He built an altar, sacrificed clean animals and birds to the Lord. So you don't want to sacrifice your only pair. Right? So there are enough for a sacrifice. But it says in chapter 7, verse 15, they went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded, and the Lord shut him in. So, when you look at Eden, and you look at the ark, there's a lot of similarities. Then when you look at the tabernacle, there's a lot of similarities. And hopefully, I wish we could. We had time to really, maybe I'll send a video of this. But it's a really, really interesting thing. But what is happening basically is that it's a microcosm. Okay, Eden is a microcosm. This is the place from which God communes with humanity. And if he's partaking with the tree of life, he's communing with God, sharing life with God, receiving life from God. But then Eden, it says, is at the top. It doesn't say it's at the top of a mountain, but how do we know it was at the top of a mountain? It says, out of Eden flowed a river, and from that river, it divides into four rivers and waters everything. So, I mean, the source of the water has to be up high. You know, this is why we have water towers. So Eden is up, and it's a mountain tabernacle. And God comes down, and he dwells there, and he walks with humanity. But then out of that place, God's glory goes forth. And the image of God was to be fruitful and multiply based in that place. Okay? And this is what then the ark becomes on behalf of all of creation. I'm judging everything that's outside of this ark. It's all under judgment. It all has to go. Those in the ark are safe. And there's a door, right? There's a door in the side of the ark. And you can go out. So then when the judgment subsides and the flood subsides, they exit the ark and the process begins again. And from this people, from within this holy place, you could call it, humanity goes forth and the earth is filled again. All the way to chapter 11. So you see God's judgment and you also see God's mercy. Right? And in both of those, you see God's faithfulness. You see his faithfulness to stick with his creation. You see his grief over those who fill the earth, not with his image, but with violence. And he says, if violence continues, I need to make an end of this. It would have been better if they weren't here. The whole point of creating man was to make it better, to cultivate it, to make it flourish. But if what you do is sever yourself from God, then what comes forth from your life is not cultivating and flourishing. It's violence and degradation and curse. So in the story of Noah and the ark, and then in the Tower of Babel, you get two perfect glimpses of the state of humanity. Okay, this is what it is. It's violence. But then in the Tower of Babel, God says, I'm not going to flood the earth. But look what they can do. God himself kind of seems to be a little bit impressed. Like, you figured out bricks. That's amazing. There will be no end to what you can do now. And literally, I mean, we just walked around Washington, D.C. all week, and God was right. There's no end to what we can do with these bricks, all the things that we can build. But God doesn't judge them by drowning, blotting them out. God confuses their language. He disrupts their ability to work together, and also disperses them over the face of the earth. And so that's what happens. God judges humanity because the earth is corrupt through them. They flourish and grow again. And then God says, I need to bring judgment again. And so he confuses and disperses them. And so that's the that's the state of the world when he chooses Abraham. All right? We've already gone through a worldwide flood and then a worldwide confusion of language and dispersion. and now mankind is just scattered and proud, and there's no sense of human beings belonging to God and communing with him. And so God picks Abraham and starts over from there, which again starts the cycle over. Be fruitful and multiply. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So that brings us to the end of this primeval history. And I hope what we've seen about God is, number one, that, you know, God, he takes the initiative, right? He started this. He is a creator. In the beginning, God created, right? He didn't make a mistake. This, he created exactly what he desired. And mankind had an opportunity to have this glorious relationship with the Creator. We chose independence from God. And that's the thing. This is the essence of the lie, and it's all through chapters 1 through 11. It's all through Scripture, especially chapters 1 through 11. It's that humanity cannot achieve what it's meant to achieve if we're saddled with the commands of God. Somehow God is holding us back from being all that we can be. That was the essence of the lie to Eve. And that you still see that heart behind the city, what Lamech does, you know, two wives. Let's have all kinds of wives. You see it in Cain building a city and naming it after his son. You see it in the Tower of Babel. Let's make a name for ourselves. We're capable of some pretty amazing stuff. So you see humanity wrestle with this fact that if we do it God's way, we will somehow become less than human, less than we are capable of being. And that is the fundamental lie that plagues every generation of the human race. If we listen to God, if we surrender to God, if we obey God, we will be less than what we were destined to be. But the exact opposite is true. Think about it. If we obey God, we become everything that we were created to be. We weren't created to just do amazing things here on earth. We were created to partake of the life, the divine life, to bring that divinity here into the earth. You can't do that when you're just out toiling away under the sun. And so, but not only that, that when you turn away from God, that is in fact what begins the process of dehumanization. Right? The worst and most dehumanizing things that humans have done are done in the name of independence and autonomy. Right? I mean, just a quick scan through recent human history can attest to this. Right? What were the great socialist, communist, totalitarian governments? They were governments that finally got God out of the picture. And we were pure science, pure sociology. We can finally do this without the taint of religion, the opiate of the masses, right? Reason. We can govern ourselves. And then you just see massive atrocities committed in the name of human flourishing, utopia, right? Nothing kills more people than trying to create a utopia. You go through all of human, you try to create a perfect society. You try to create a very good place. You try to create a flourishing environment. And you say, no thanks, God, we're going to figure this out on our own. And there are mass graves. That's just what happens. And so this is the story. That's Genesis 1 through 11. We don't know how to do this. We don't know how to figure it out. There's the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we pick that because it looks so good. And we think it will be, we think it will take us where we were destined to go. And it's just death, death, death all the time. And so that's what, that's the state of humanity. And that's what Jesus had to choose Abraham, call Abraham to begin to address, right? So next week, we're going to start plodding through the story of God's, the early story of God's people from Abraham and onward. And really, Genesis takes us from the family to the nation, right? Exodus deals with the nation of Israel. All right, so just some powerful reminders of what the essence of sin is. And, you know, it's written here on kind of an epic proportion, epic scale. But just think about it in your own life. Right? I think we can all testify to this, that when we are pretty confident that we got things figured out, there's pretty much disaster that is waiting around the corner for us. Right? Sin is crouching at the door. When we don't trust God, when we operate in fear, when we operate in the mentality that I've got to make the most of this life, or I'm going to miss out on something, God's withholding something from me. When we operate in that way, our life isn't better. We're not happier. There's no more joy. We're miserable, more and more miserable. Our relationships aren't good. They're bad when we operate in that way. It breaks down. We get jealous. We get angry. We get murderous. Right? We don't necessarily rise up and slay someone in the field, but we get some pretty bitter, violent hearts toward one another. And God comes to save us from that. Amen. And he calls us to come and lay down our lives. And once again, he gives us an opportunity to come back into that fellowship with him where we say, yes, we want to partake of the tree of life. We don't want to think this through on our own. It's so powerful. I mean, that's it. That's life. There are two ways. There's one of life, one of death. And Jesus comes to offer us life. So let's pray and then we'll come to the table.